But I think Ghost have found the one real world
application of blockchain technology is harnessing fear.
Yep.
Yeah. I think it wasn't the moral of Monsters, Inc. that actually laughter is more powerful for
it was. It was a very nice message.
But, yeah.
But I don't know. I think that's not true in the real world, though. I think it's still mostly just fear.
Scotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 175 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm a spooky ghost.
I'm Sam, and I'm secretly a dog.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is Octobertron T9.
Otherwise known as Halloween.
Well, Halloween's 2 days from the time we record.
Yep.
But it's today.
But it's today.
According to listeners.
Also, before we get started, we have a warning. Anything could happen on this show. There's going to be profanity, and we're going to talk about adult topics.
It's going to get real spooky, too, because it's Halloween.
Yep.
So children are easily spooked, as we all know, and they should definitely not listen because of on account of the spookiness factor. All right, let's get on to our Ko-Fi supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. We'd like to thank Alex RC, who's a new supporter, who said, couldn't make it out to Shenanicon, but I hope it's a blast. Alex in Connecticut. So thank you very much. We also have several recurring supporters we'd like to thank. So thank you guys for keeping keeping our microphones on. All right, on to studio news. All right, so let's talk about Shenanicon. Let's talk about the elephant in the room.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Shenanicon.
Big. No, we don't want to talk about the actual elephant in the room.
No,
because we also own an elephant.
No, we're not talking about that. We're going to talk about the other elephant in the room,
okay,
which is Shenanigans.
Gotcha.
How did it go? How was it? What happened?
Okay.
What even? I mean, I guess everybody heard it, kind of.
We did the live episode, which was awesome. All of our voices were absolutely destroyed. So I don't know if you could tell listening. I think it was a little bit, a little rough.
We were hoarse.
Yeah, because we were getting things organized for the Shenanicon, so we were talking and talking and talking for several hours before the convention started, and then we had a half hour of mingling with everybody, talk, then gave a talk for 30 minutes, then podcast. So that was
a lot of chat,
brutal on the old cords.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun, though.
Yeah, it was great. It was so fun to meet people. We had people from just all over the place. People from Florida and Texas and Michigan. It was kind of wild, I mean, who can be like, people came from those places to come just see what we got going on and hang out for a day.
It was super fun.
Very fun. So we do have it in the plans already. Shenanicon 2 is in motion. So we had enough fun that we were like, we maybe haven't figured out exactly how to make money off this yet, but we're going to figure it out next year.
Well, the goal is to stop losing money first.
Yes.
And then break even.
Yeah. One of our attendees did ask, they were like, you guys can't be making money off this. Like, I just know from the ticket price and everything that's going on, they're like, there's no way. And I was like, correct.
That's correct. You have done the math.
But he's like, what's it for? And I was like, well, just trying to figure it out. Do an experiment so that when we want to do like a big version of something like this, that it's both understood and possible. So next year, we already have like sort of all of our kit and stuff ready to go. And it's going to be
So the plan easier at the moment is to do a very similar thing, same time of year. So that we'll have the dates coming out probably in the beginning of the new year.
And we also got, I think another sort of, one of the reasons that we wanted to do the Shenanicon is because so much of what we do with the podcast, with Discord, with the blog, et cetera, these are all public archives of information that we're putting out there. And one of the things that we've always wanted to do for our hardcore fans is give them secrets that nobody else has and let them see kind of how things work behind the scenes in the studio, maybe give them early access previews to things that other people may not know yet. And so we can't, of course, announce secrets on the podcast or anything because it's not a secret anymore.
Yep.
And so we were able to do some of that. So we had some special announcements and things.
And one of those will actually be announced publicly tomorrow. Your tomorrow, listeners.
Tomorrow,
Thursday.
Just this Thursday.
Thursday, yes.
Yeah. Once the spookiness has subsided, then the announcement will come.
Yeah, we didn't want to – we had some big news, but we thought people are too scared right now.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't want people to miss it. Mm-hmm. So it's coming out after October is done.
Yeah.
So keep an eye out for
that. The ghosts, they're back in their graves or wherever ghosts go, basements, under beds.
I think
they
just kind of go wherever they want. They're ghosts, you know?
Yeah, but they do kind of come out en masse, you know, during
that's true.
During this time.
Spook season.
Yeah.
What do you think that's – why is that?
They're like a migratory
flock. It's basically like a conference, I think. You know, just like all game developers go to GDC and you know,
all the ghosts are out there like, "Hey, you going to Halloween this year?
Yeah, exactly.
To Halloween?"
You're like, here's my 20 slide deck about how to optimize the spook rate in your house, such that you know you can withdraw as much fear from your user base as possible.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's all about that user experience.
It's all about engagement, long term spook factor.
Yep.
I wonder. Yeah, so they must like share tips. About like, yeah, you know, what you want to do is, you know, because there's all those different schools of thought of how to spook people.
Sure.
Yep. You know, maybe it's just something like,
spook up front, you know, there might be
It's true. You want to just hit them once real big and then just now you're just, that's it. You know? One big spook.
Right. Or, you know, maybe you just want like a recurring, you know, sort of like a spook subscription where it's like once a day when somebody looks away and then they look back, you have slightly moved something that they were just interacting with, you know, and that's just very kind of mildly spooky over a long period of time.
Yep.
And that kind of maximizes your lifetime spook
factor,
you know.
But you also have to be much more likely to have someone fall out. You know, there's a spook funnel, right? And people are going to fall out.
Yeah, because at some point people are like, this is too spooky, and then they move and they leave.
Yeah, or they're like, you know, it just continues going on the same way forever.
Yeah,
and like I just need something new.
Yeah, I'm not spooked anymore because it's just I'm used to it now. You know, I know that every time I turn away, a book will have moved on the shelf or something, and it's just not really getting
me. I think it's a big part of it is, you know, not being 100% consistent with your spookiness is actually one of the keys to being spooky.
Yeah, this is why procedurally generated spookiness is really kind of falling out of favor because when you randomize your spookiness using just a generic formula, then it kind of just comes out the same.
As this
you
weird know,
people
like
see the patterns.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you want to get those spook surprises.
That's how you keep jump scares because otherwise, if it's just jump scare after jump scare, then you know. You're expecting it now.
Yeah, exactly. It's like being in a haunted house. You know, you can only do it for like 30 minutes and you're like, okay, I'm done.
Yeah. So hopefully maybe this year, you know, we'll see some new spook models.
Some good innovation.
Coming out.
Yeah. In spookization.
Because the industry is really, really good. It's real hot right now.
Yep.
things are taking off.
Especially right now.
We got some spooky VR. It's like kind of the big one right now.
Yeah.
Spooky blockchain.
Thing going on the spook chain.
Spook chain. Yeah.
There's a lot of innovation happening, but we just haven't really seen it applied, you know, super effectively yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of hard to actually apply it on a broad scale right away.
Yeah.
You know, takes some time to percolate through.
We have things like, you know, Monsters, Inc. was an example of this, where they, you know, they captured fear screams.
Yeah, they use children's screams to power their cities.
So I'm sure that, you know, someone's trying to put fear on the blockchain. Like, how can I generate, you know, maximum spooks? And then put them on the blockchain and then move those spooks
around.
Actually,
this is probably really good for ghosts because I assume that ghosts use fear as a currency. But I think before the blockchain, it was probably really hard to get some sort of
there's no guarantee of uniqueness. Exactly. Like somebody gets scared and you're like, yeah, but how do I know that that emotion wasn't stolen from somebody else?
Right.
You don't know.
So put it on the blockchain.
Put it on the blockchain.
I think ghosts have found the one real world
application of blockchain technology is harnessing fear.
Yep.
Yeah. I think it wasn't the moral of Monsters, Inc. that actually laughter is more powerful for
it was. It was a very nice message.
But, yeah.
But I don't know. I think that's not true in the real world, though. I think it's still mostly just fear.
Fear is pretty powerful.
Yeah. In terms of spooky stuff, I had some spooky dreams last night. Usually I don't remember my dreams at all, but for some reason my dreams were all
very
tornado themed.
Okay. We chatted a little bit about tornadoes yesterday.
So yeah, I was telling my wife. Yeah, I think that's where it came from. I was talking about
that's wife. Called an Iowa ghost.
Exactly. But I was telling them, they're just giant.
A big, ghosts. Loud Iowa ghost.
But I was telling my wife about them this morning because I was pretty amused because the first one, I was on a four wheeler or an ATV for, I don't know. I don't know what people call these normally. So I was on an ATV. I think my wife might have been on the back. I can't remember for sure, but we were driving down the road. Right. Mm-hmm. And I was looking ahead and all of a sudden I saw like kind of the faint outlines, basically a ghost, right? But the faint outlines of something. And all of a sudden I saw cars getting flung off the road. And then I realized it was like a little mini tornado that was just coming right down the road.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, fuck. And so I, you know, made a hard left turn and just went off of the road as far as I could. And then kind of looked behind me, stopped, and then watched the tornado pass by.
Oh, okay.
And it was fine.
Because as long as you're not actually touching it, you're not affected by the
wind.
Yeah,
then you're fine. Exactly. Yeah. So then I... Before I got left to get back on the road, I looked back and there was just some dude staring at me. So it was like a little of a switch up, you know.
So it was kind of a G-man situation.
He was more like he was a farmer or something who was just, you know, like maybe I was on his property, I don't know. But then he started chasing me.
Oh.
Just like running, like a fucking dead sprint.
Maybe the tornado turned into a man.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know what happened. So then I'm like, what the fuck? So then I, you know, floor it and get back on the road. But somehow he's like really catching up to me, even though I'm just
Well, you didn't
really
floor
fast.
It, you thumbed it.
I thumbed it, exactly. Yeah.
You're driving an ATV.
Yeah, because I'm an ATV. And so I'm just flooring it, and then and he's still running fast, and he gets up alongside me.
Ah.
So then
Oh shit.
So then I kick him.
Okay.
Except that I kicked in real life and woke myself up.
Well, he was scary enough to get you back in your body.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Somehow, like, me kicking his incorporeal form, you know, brought me
this
back.
This is going to be the new – so you know how there's, like, these –
Slender Man?
Yeah. Well, there's Slender Man, and then I think there's that one guy who lives in people's dreams.
Yeah, it's Freddy Krueger, I think.
So I think maybe the farmer is going to be the next –
It's the tornado farmer.
That's the tornado farmer. It's the next big spooky thing that's coming.
Yeah. It was – But it was funny because I was just kind of annoyed that I woke myself up. So I wasn't actually spooked when I woke up, despite everything about it. Yeah, it should have been spooky.
Yeah, my dream last night was that I was hopping planets for some reason. We stop at this planet and everyone's like, it's really beautiful down there, super lush. Just don't look at the goats. There's the goats. Just don't look at them. And I was like, okay. So I go down there.
How do you know where not to look until you look to know where
they
are?
That's exactly the problem. So I'm just –
This is the same problem with Slender Man, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm like wandering through this like this very beautiful tropical sort of jungle, and then this – and it's a goat technically in terms of like shape, but it does not feel like a goat. It's a very alien goat. But I accidentally look it in the eyes, and then its eyes glow super bright, and then it starts shooting lasers at me. And I had to run away while it was like – It was like alternating like an AT-AT sort of just like shooting laser blasts toward me.
It was making those. It was like, pew, 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 pew.
No, it was just walking slowly, chewing, and shooting lasers.
I guess if you could do that, you wouldn't really need to chase anybody.
Because you got lasers.
Yeah. So it was just still hanging out, chewing, and eating just very nonchalant.
Yeah, it's like, I'll just be standing here until you die.
I'm just going to hang out and just laser you with my laser goat eyes.
Yep.
So, okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is all very spooky stuff. I'm glad we got that out of the way.
Yeah, watch out.
Otherwise, studio news. Levelhead is not coming out in November.
Surprise!
Surprise!
So we set that launch target a few months ago, actually. And it was a pretty ambitious target, but also it was based purely on sort of what was in the game at that time.
So this is something that just routinely happens, which is that... you know, and the iterative nature of how we build games in particular is very prone to this, which is that you think you're going to be done because you think you know exactly what's in the game, and then something happens and you come up with something new. And
well, you hit a decision point where you say like, okay, with this new idea, this new thing that if we put it in, it changes everything, right? And it's going to make the game stand out in all kinds of amazing ways. It's going to solve all these problems that the current version of the game has, et cetera, et cetera. So we could just go ahead and launch it anyway, like without this new idea and hit our target, or we could take the extra time, get this thing hooked up, and whenever it's done, it's done, right? So
yeah, so it's not done. So
we opted for that second.
We're saying a vague 2019 sometime at this time.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah.
It better come out 2019.
Yeah. And this marbles. This is one of those really positive delays in the sense that we're not going to announce what it is that we're putting in the game.
It's because we stumbled onto something awesome, and so we just have to do it.
Yeah,
it's going to take a while.
We had the conversation a couple weeks ago about implementing this mystery feature, and it came down to like, there's no way that this could work because like this is so fucking weird compared to what we've seen in other games like this. Other platformers and stuff like that. But we decided to prototype it anyways. So in about a day and a half, we had a vaguely working prototype of this weird idea. And it was way better even than we could have anticipated. And now this changes everything. And now we've got us.
So now we're stuck.
Yeah. So we're keeping it low key. We're not announcing it until we have something more concrete to show. Mm-hmm. But just know that it's going to...
It'll be good. It'll take a while.
Socks are going to fly right off, right off of your pants. Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about Fallout 76.
Let's do it.
I want to know about it. because I don't.
So Seth knows nothing about this. So some of our users might know about our podcast listeners. Sorry.
What is Fallout generally?
Fallout generally is a franchise that takes place in a dystopian future that was essentially frozen in the 1950s, but also has very rad technology. But it's very heavy technology.
Well, it's basically because there was a nuclear apocalypse in the 50s.
Correct.
Everybody went into underground bunkers.
Called vaults.
Called vaults, maintained by the company Vault Tech.
Mm-hmm.
And then some number of years later, these start to open and people go back out into to whatever the world is now.
They generally call it the Wasteland.
The Wasteland.
Right. Pretty, and then the Wasteland is covered in scorpions, giant scorpions, giant bees.
Bandits, mutants.
Everything is giant now.
Yeah, that's one of the good side effects of
everything's giant now except for people explosions. Who are wrinkly.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, there are very wrinkly people involved in this whole thing. So Fallout 76 is the newest game in this series of games. And all of the previous ones have been very large single-player experiences where you are wandering the wastes.
Huge campaign. Huge vault story. Yeah.
Exactly. And this newest one is a bit of a departure because they made it so that instead of just you being you out in the wasteland doing your thing, you're actually on a server with a bunch of randos. So you're out there in an open world environment that's basically built the same way as the previous ones, apparently from what I've heard about it. Same quest structure sort of things. Not really much changes actually to the fundamental nature of the thing. But there are tons of other people, real human people, running around.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe they can just talk on voice chat if you're nearby.
Yeah, I think so.
So
cool.
Which is already a terrible feature.
That sounds like a recipe for disaster.
I assume there's the option to turn that off because that was literally the first thing that I will do.
I hope so. So I wanted to talk a little bit about it because I think it's a really interesting departure for a series that's been extremely successful in a particular way. And then to say, hey, we're going to turn this basically into an MMO. Like, that's essentially what this is.
Well, in particular, into a survival game because now people are going to be murdering each other.
Yes.
Right? So it's going to feel... But I mean, it sounded to me like it would feel more like something like Rust than – it'd be like Fallout combined with Rust or something, which is not the kind of experience that I would be looking forward to necessarily.
Well, and one of the things that made the original series of Fallout games really cool and interesting was that because it's a single-player game, you're going against known quantities. You know, you're going against known things in the environment, and so you can play through the same game multiple times, and you can try really dumb stuff and try to make it work. Because even if you're like, I'm just going to punch things, like I'm going to punch everything and I'm going to try to get like this weird power fist item and et cetera, et cetera. And you know that for the most part, that's pretty suboptimal, right? Like it's probably better to just like shoot stuff. But it's so dumb that it's fun,
yes.
Right? One of the things that having a sort of an MMO or a multiplayer slant to things is that if you have to do things with a group of people at any point – then people will try to take the person who is not playing like an idiot.
Yes.
Right?
They'll take anybody
even
else.
Though it's way more fun to play like an idiot.
But also presumably that there are certain play styles that are really classic in that kind of game, like heavy sneak, which is what I always go with, right?
Yeah. Which how are you going to sneak?
Yeah, it only works because you can just tell AIs not to see you, right?
Right.
But when it comes to other players, like they're not going to make you invisible. So they'll just look at you crouching, like walk around as if you're invisible. But other players will just see you the whole time, right? Yeah, so it'll completely change.
Unless you actually do just like crouch and then you're just gone.
Because you have that little radar thing, you know, that on the UI. Mm-hmm. So maybe like that'll still have you not show up or something. Yeah.
The interesting thing I read a few, they had basically a big open beta. So other people have actually gotten to hop in and play it.
Yeah, I think only on Xbox.
Yes, and I read a few of the sort of general takes on it, and the general feeling that I got from it was essentially that actually one of the things that's really special about the Fallout games is the tone, which is – it is this dystopian thing. It's very dark, but also like there's really good writing and very good humor, and the quest's really fun.
It's basically a dark comedy.
Yeah, but you can imagine if you were watching a dark comedy and then the audience members randomly would just like say shit or talk about their day. Loudly enough for you to hear it in the middle of this, or in the case
of the
voice chat thing, someone was describing like they went into a vault, which is usually very exciting because you get to like each vault was actually secretly an experiment of some sort by this company, and so each one has its own like little weird story.
And so you normally go up to a computer terminal and it's you read emails sent by one person to another person inside the vault.
Yeah, you kind of slowly piece together the puzzle, and then you'll find horrifying things. Like there was this one vault that was just full of the same person named Gary.
Yeah.
And there's just like numbers like Gary 1, Gary 2, all the way up to like Gary 50. Like that. Yep. And so you're just fighting a bunch of Garys, and all they do is they say, Gary! And so it's just a vault of clones. And so
and every so like a Pokemon with plant people.
Yeah. So every so often, like you come in with these things, and it's just weird and fun. But someone was describing, they walked in, and then two other people walked in behind them. And those two people started, of course, looting everything. So, you know, you go to the drawers, you check to see if there's any ammo. And then they went and did it and also got ammo. And they said, like, the immersion breaking was so hard on it. And then it also made it – so it was just weird because they were sort of, like, trying to keep up with these people. But also, like, they really actually wanted to be there for the story. So it doesn't seem to actually jive effectively.
So this is an interesting thing that I've been, as you guys know, I've been playing WoW since it came out in 2004. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that I got into the idea of game design to begin with was watching Blizzard deploy patches to this game and then seeing the fallout of those design decisions and how they affected player behavior and community, stuff like that. And even things like if you have what's supposed to be an online persistent world, it's supposed to create the feeling of people being in the same space. But then you put things in the world that violate those rules, like, oh, these people just emptied out a drawer and now I go and loot it and it's full again because we each have our own magical version of the drawer. So you have these sort of like multiplayer forgiveness mechanics to make it so that people don't have to interact and don't actually have to talk to each other. Then it completely kills like the whole point of it being a shared universe, right? Mm-hmm. So I was telling Adam this over the weekend as I was playing like vanilla style WoW over this past weekend, and I'm running up and I see this sack. It's like for a quest that I'm supposed to like pick up these 5 sacks or whatever. I run up, I'm about to pick up the sack, and a harpy comes running in. She's like, bah! And starts like hitting me in the face with claws. And now I can't pick up the sack because every time I try to, it gets interrupted, right? So I'm like, and I'm trying to pick up the sack. I got to eventually fight this harpy. So as I'm fighting this harpy, I'm battling, and I'm really low level and I'm weak and it's taking forever. And then this troll warrior comes running up, and he just kind of like, he looks at me, he sees me, and he turns back to the sack. He turns back, and I'm like, don't you fucking do it, buddy. He goes, he takes the sack, and he leaves. I'm like, you son. So I battle the harpy. I'm like, it's okay. It's fine.
Harpy's
like,
dead. We're still here.
I'm still good. Uh-huh. There's plenty of sacks to go around, but still, total dick move.
Plenty of sacks in the sea,
But the point here is that, like, this changed something, right? So, like, his behavior actually changed something about my experience.
Right.
Because then, about 15 minutes later, I'm at another end of this Harpy Canyon, and who do I see come running up being attacked by 3 harpies at once?
Oh.
This troll.
Guess who's not getting any help today, troll?
Guess who's a healer? Me, with a single press of a button.
Did you just look at him?
I looked at him. I typed / nod. So am I just like, my character's just like, you nod at this guy. And then he just gets killed by these 3 harpies, and I'm like, yeah, guess who gets all the sacks now, buddy?
This is the small town effect of actually sharing a space.
Yeah, and this is the magic of having these persistent shared universes is that everybody pools into the same resources, right? Mm-hmm. And so everything that you do, even in really small ways, spills out into other people's game experience.
Yeah.
And as soon as you undo those mechanics and like make it so that everybody might as well just be by themselves – then why, like, what's the
– well, yeah, that's sort of
– now you're just playing a single-player game and you have to listen to weirdos yelling.
That was the vibe. You know? Which is like, yeah, now it's just Fallout but with weird interruptions from humans.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, nothing about this sounds appealing to me, but probably still play it, of course. Cause
yeah. I know they were talking about maybe doing private servers and stuff so you could like run your own or something. But
I doubt there. I mean,
because it would be like if I could sit down because my wife also loves the Fallout series.
Playing Fallout multiplayer with precisely with your friends.
That would probably be
even then awesome. Though, because if nothing you do requires real communication,
True. Yeah. Like, but it's still more like because normally it's like when a new Fallout comes out, my wife and I will just like we'll go up into the office and then we'll just she'll sit at her desk, I'll sit at my desk, and we'll just play Fallout like the whole fucking weekend, right? Mm-hmm. Which of course is also great. We talk about what we're up to and whatever. But if we got to play
sort of in sync
with each other, even though there's these sort of things that violate stuff, right? In terms of the immersion,
super fun.
I still think it would be a hugely good time.
Yeah, strangers are not friends, though. You know,
if the game systems don't force strangers to become friends, then you're just surrounded by strangers literally the whole time you're playing a game.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of that is if you're not intending to have a social experience with a game, or you're not intending to get like really into it,
yeah,
then the overhead of having to socialize in order to, you know, get loot out in the world or whatever, because I think for a lot of people play multiplayer games basically as a single player. This is true for like Diablo also, right? Where mm-hmm. you want to go and you want to rank up, you want to do your stuff. And so it always feels like people are taking things away from you, you know, and it always feels like it's mm-hmm. a problem that other people are there unless you have this sort of shared, you know, loot system or whatever. And I think it's only those hardcore players who are really in there for the social experience and for right. for the deep immersion who want to put in that effort and that work to get in there and really just try to
I don't know. I think honestly my experience has been the opposite. That it's the hardcore players who want only single player because they want to go as fast as they can without other people bogging them down, without being slowed down by like having to find a group to do something, et cetera, et cetera. Because they just want to go as fast as possible, right? And oftentimes what I've seen is that a lot of people in MMOs will want to play because they can just like – it's almost like going to the bar, right? They get to log in and hang out. They're going at their own pace. Every now and then they'll be like, oh, this thing is super hard. Anybody want to join me with this? And other people are like, sure, because it's fine, you know, because you just group up for stuff. And so even if you're bad at the game or you don't really know a lot about the game, you overcome the game's obstacles – by just the nature that you have friends playing the game, right?
Yeah.
So instead of having
have friends play the game, right. I'm talking about that initial experience when you don't know anybody. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are assholes, right? Because I know, like forever ago, when I played Diablo 2 a lot, like as a kid, basically. I remember trying to like get into the multiplayer part because you know you'd go somewhere that people would just like take all the gold or take all the loot or whatever. Always be like right in front of you grabbing all the stuff because there was no shared.
During boss fights, you had to be right next to the boss because the boss was a fountain of loot, and then whoever was closest. Yeah.
But this is all reinforced by mechanics because I could say that you know aside from this troll who I let die, I've interacted with several hundred players over the weekend, and every single one of those interactions was very positive.
Yeah.
And so like even something like you come across a quest area, like, oh, I'm supposed to defeat this quest mob. It's super hard. And also it's on a 10-minute respawn timer. So it's not even there because somebody's recently defeated it. So I come up there and somebody else is there and they're like, hey, like, oh, we're on the same quest. Like, you want to join up? I'm like, hell yeah. And then a third person comes in like, hey guys, what's going on? And then
it's like a sitcom.
We got a three person group, you know, and then eventually you've got like three groups of five all waiting for this thing to respawn. And everybody's having a conversation like, oh, were you guys here first? It's fine. Like, we'll wait. And everybody kind of like forms a line, you know, to do this thing. But it is because of the mechanical reinforcement of the social interaction, which is everybody's playing on the same server.
Yeah.
And in a game like Diablo, it's a huge pool of millions of players, right? Yep.
So the worlds aren't synced.
So yeah.
You don't come in the same place.
Yeah. So you run up, you join somebody's boss run and you steal their loot and you leave and they're never going to see you again.
Yep.
You know, and that's just it, right? It's the like, hey, I'm walking here. Like that,
yep.
That like, you know, New York cliche, right?
Yeah.
So I do think that not all online experiences are equal. And it's kind of up to the game designers to recognize that their design decisions completely affect how people are going to treat one another.
Yeah, well, and I think having a instance loot is probably the easiest way to not have to design the game around your multiplayer experience. So that if you're saying this is sort of like Diablo 3 with its
that's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, full instance loot. We're basically like Diablo 3 is effectively a single player experience, right? Because it doesn't really matter that there are other people there. And because, of course, they also scale the difficulty as you add players. And so in the end, kind of it all comes out the same. Yep. And I know my experience playing that with my wife was that I was just bored basically the whole time.
Yeah.
Because everything's always scaling with you. And, you know, I mean, it was a weird experience then because the loot was then not shared because.
You don't ever have to talk about that. And also you wouldn't even see some great item drop for her,
yeah,
and then be happy for her that she got this awesome thing.
Yeah, she would just have to tell me that she got.
She would tell you about it. You're like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah, right? you can still get loot for other classes and stuff. So then we would still like go split up loot in town and do that sort of thing.
But it's rarer actually too.
Yeah,
yeah. And I think that especially in a game like Diablo or something where so much of the game is about the loot. That is the whole game basically. To take that and remove
it's loot box, the game.
Yeah. Like every monster you kill is just a little miniature loot box, right?
Yep.
which you're not paying for, thankfully. but because the loot was very social as well in Diablo 2, which mm-hmm. is...
Because it had to be. Because when my wife and I played that one, we'd be like... We'd be working on – each one of us would have a weapon with some slots in it, you know, mm-hmm. that we'd found that we really liked. And we'd be working on, you know, splitting up our gems that we would each kind of have an equal share.
Yeah.
You know, and mm-hmm. so
but there's also a layer of trust. We're like, it means something to play with somebody who you trust.
Yep.
Because a great item drops for you and they're not going to fucking run up Uber and snatch it.
Like a vacuum.
Yeah. Yeah. And so by stripping away the player's ability to do bad stuff like that – you also strip away the ability for players for trust to even matter. Yeah. Right.
Well, they would.
But if the game design doesn't allow for trust to develop, yeah.
Because it's not shared.
Right. It's your only option.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, I'm really curious. You can kind of see how these cascading things come into play.
Yeah. Right? I think you're right that if Fallout 76 had private servers, so you could just play with friends and then had non-instance loot. So everybody had to like negotiate.
Divvy it up.
So, yeah. Then that would make it a very fun part of the experience is playing that because Fallout is also all about the loot.
Yeah, you know? It is. Yeah,
well,
it
really is. Yeah, because there's a lot of mechanics that I've seen creeping into various online games like Diablo 3. Actually, I mean, Blizzard has kind of taken this philosophy toward their online games of always making it so that it doesn't truly matter whether other people are there, yeah. right? So your character in Diablo 3 should always be able to do everything to maximum effectiveness. And if depending on your class, it just kind of changes like what animations you see while you're one-shotting everything.
It's
right?
a flavor choice yeah. more so.
It's a flavor choice. And then like as more players enter, the enemies get sort of like mildly stronger, but they're still not really that strong and it's fine. And you see the same thing with creatures in World of Warcraft. Now, as you level up, they level up with you. And so your gear no longer makes you stronger than other things. And so... So the world no longer feels like a world. The
that's
world,
a bummer.
Yeah, the world feels it like is. A game because if it was a persistent world that was trying to like be a realistic place, then things are what they are, mm-hmm. right? And so you can like see – you can fight a thing like, oh, that was way too hard. I'm going to go get stronger and like come back and fight it. But then now everything scales to be just like average in difficulty. Mm-hmm. So no matter how strong you are, you're always going to have the same experience fighting every single creature.
About one of the really fun parts, not just about games, but just about acquiring an expertise in general, is coming back to something that was hard a while
yeah.
ago
yeah.
and just crushing it. Just crushing
yeah.
it. Whether it's,
this like, is what people love about Dark Souls.
You yeah. know, whether that, you're playing yeah. an RPG or if it's like a genuine skill mastery in the real world. Like I think Adam recently been looking back at rebuilding one of our key pieces of software in the studio, Thinkbot.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of under the previous direction, it was going to be this like big, crazy, like software project was going to take forever. And then he had this, after sort of sitting on it for a while, this sort of insight about how to do it. And it looks like it's going to be way more fun.
It's now a much easier problem, way more fun to do. Yeah, just the whole yeah. thing changed.
And so it's like, it's the same thing. It's like when Crash lands, when you like, you fight a big womp at first and you're like, oh my God. We had someone at the Shineticon who talked about how it took them, they fought a womp lord, which is the very special wompets when they were level one. It took him 7 days and 7 nights to whittle it down to
yeah. time. Of game time. Not of game not time. Real yeah. life.
Yeah, so they're just – which is probably –
it's a 20-minute cycle, isn't it? Or
the whole thing I think is 16 minutes? I can't remember. Day, night.
I can't remember.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's like an hour. An hour of just like fighting this one wampit.
Yeah.
And you can imagine then, you know, coming back after you're halfway through the bog, like 15 hours deep and just like –
just
crushing
one-shotting that thing.
Yeah. And it feels so good because it's a measurement of your power. And yeah. so – yeah, I mean, being able to have those in games, I think, is super important.
Yeah, and we did that with the bosses in Crashlands. On the harder modes, the bosses scale up. With
yeah, they scale
with have you. They have a minimum level yeah. so that, like, they – like, let's say a boss is level 20 or something like that. So if you're level 10, you're not going to have a chance, mm-hmm. right? Once you get up to level 20, then you are now sort of at the difficulty level of that boss. And then as you go higher, the boss goes with you, right? Right. Because the point of that one was – the point of the harder difficulty modes – was that those fights should just be really hard.
They're just skill-based at that point.
Yeah. 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 So you shouldn't be out-gearing mm-hmm. those things. But everything else in the world does not scale with you. You just, you know, you get the better stuff, you get the better equipment, you come back and you beat the crap out of it, you know. And that's really what the satisfaction of the power loop is, you know, the RPG.
Yeah. I'm really curious how the Fallout thing works. I mean, I'm sure I'll play it when it comes out, but
– yeah.
I'm going to wait a while, actually, on this one because I don't want to be there when everyone's there.
Well, it sounds like –
someone described their experience coming out of the vault and they said they walk out of the vault and they're like taking in this vista, just like the usual opening scene situation, like, oh my God, everything's broken. And then someone appears next to them and then started trying to punch them.
Skullcrusher 420 shows up.
They could hear him on voice chat.
Yeah.
Like being frustrated that they couldn't figure out how to punch.
Kill this person. And then they were like, fuck this game. And they run off. Like, that's your entrance.
Yeah. Imagine that being your opening experience. And I think I've talked about the podcast before. Still one of my favorite game experiences was for the first time playing a Fallout game, Fallout 3,
and leaving the vault.
Because you spend like the first probably like 20 minutes or half an hour or something in the vault.
It's very claustrophobic.
Yeah, it's claustrophobic. But like, you're learning the story. You're kind of figuring out what's going on. And this crazy sequence of events happens that causes you to have to leave the vault. And then you like walk out for the first time, right? And it's just such a good feeling moment. Mm-hmm. That I've also talked about how, like, as soon as you've done that once, you actually can't recapture that in another game anyway. So it's already kind of gone. But it's still, it's for the other Fallout games, it's been like the thing I always look forward to when I start in the vault and then
exit.
And then you're exiting, uh-huh. right?
And then get into this guy. Then,
the idea of that. Oh, we're good.
Fuck this guy.
Yeah.
That would be so
annoying. Okay. I want to know if there's a term for this, because I feel like this is something that I've seen happen over and over again, which is especially with either one game that gets developed over a long period of time, like a game like WoW or EVE Online or something mm-hmm. like that. And of course, the design team is changing hands regularly throughout this process. The company situation is changing hands. Maybe the company gets acquired or, you know, whatever. Or you got games in long running franchises, you know, like the Diablo series, 20 years old and that kind of stuff. But what seems to happen is there's some kind of like peak where it's not the first game. The first game is always, you know, it's good.
Right.
But then at some point, the game hits this point where it's like the vision feels like it's fully realized mm-hmm. of what this game is you know, like what the soul of that game is. And then after that, like that's the pinnacle mm-hmm. of that game. So maybe it's like Fallout 3, you know, mm-hmm. or whatever. And then after that, it seems like the developers are just kind of playing defense.
Mm.
Like they're trying to address complaints that people have about the game.
Right.
Trying to make things more convenient, trying to like break it into new markets, you know, like, oh, multiplayer Fallout, that's the next thing.
Yeah, I think what it is it. As a human being, you can imagine working on the same product, like the same game essentially for like 10 years.
Yeah.
I think the reality is you're going to start looking further and further afield from what the game is in order to feel like you're changing it. Because it's like the feeling of having a dynamic impact on the thing you're working on is pretty key to like feeling like you're just making an impact generally, I feel like. So I could totally see how if you're just working on the same thing for a while, at some point, like these really small changes that get brought up that at first may have like 5 years ago may have seemed like a stupid thing to do, might just sort of be exactly the thing you want to do because they will change the game, which is actually what you're looking for at that point. Less so to bring it in line with something and more to change it, if that makes sense, or to shift.
Right.
Sort of what you see generally is like it's a slow shift in the vision of what the game is supposed to be away from that, whatever that pinnacle thing was. And I think the thing is that there are other.
But I always find it interesting that that's the goal, you know, in the sense that instead of really taking a deep dive into saying like, okay, what is it that people truly love about this game,
mm-hmm.
and how do we do that better, right. you know, and also recognizing that a lot of the things that people complain about. So you know, we talked about like the 2 hour work week, right, which is like. The idea that, you know, in an average week, maybe a person's only getting like 2 hours of real work done, so we might as well cut out the other 38. But without – and, you know, sleep was the same thing. Like, oh, you only need maybe a little bit of REM sleep, and so maybe if you just stop sleeping so much, you'd still be fine. Mm-hmm. Without realizing that actually those things all live in context, right? And so maybe the other 38 hours of work is what lets the 2 hours happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same thing is true about games because you can't – you can't just like grab a little piece of the game, be like, this is the part that people like, and then ignore it in the context. And so what I feel like happens in the long term with game franchises is people as designers, they look at player complaints. So things like, oh, somebody keeps stealing all my shit in Diablo 2, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they come in and they try to address complaints. So they end up kind of like they go on the back foot. They're playing defensive.
I see what you're saying.
They go to address complaints without realizing that those things that people kind of don't like about the game are also
what allow certain mechanics to exist that are then actually super important.
Yeah.
Well, I know I personally hated, or at least thought I hated, you know, growing up, that I had to fight people for loot in Diablo 2. Mm-hmm. And when Diablo 3 came out and they were like, oh yeah, we're doing this, you know, this instance loot thing, I was so excited.
Yeah.
And actually, I enjoyed it all the way through. I was always so happy that I didn't have to fight people for loot. Like, that part of the puzzle was just gone, you know?
Yeah.
But it wasn't until, you know, in retrospect, looking back, that I was like, that actually took away
some
that other social component of the game.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I wasn't aware, because I was just so happy that I didn't have to deal with that the less visible thing, you know, like a social aspect.
You
didn't realize
that you just were playing by yourself now the whole time.
Yeah. It actually hides these other things. It hides. Yeah. So anything that you can actually just do in a game that has sort of spillover effects on player behavior is then something to be very careful about, because you can make a visible change to the game that has all these hidden effects that people aren't aware of. People are aware of the change, but not aware necessarily of the behavioral change that it causes in them.
Yeah.
And so you end up with this really bad miswanting situation where, like, I thought that I wanted to not have shared loot, which is actually still, like, if I was playing with randos, that would still be true.
Well, it becomes one of those things where instead of just talking about the shared loot, you have to talk about the other part too, which is that, okay, if you don't want shared loot, do you also not want to socialize while you're playing this game?
Yep.
Because that's literally, those are the two sides of that coin. Yeah. Right. And so I think
I want it to
that's
not,
the second
you're,
step.
Yeah, you're saying, like, I want it to not matter that other people are there.
Yeah. Yes.
And if that's true, then you are now by yourself. You're now, even though other people are there, you're alone.
Yep.
Right. You're all alone together.
Yeah.
Everybody's playing a single player game with, and there's like other quote players around that might as well just be bots. Cause
right. Yeah. And I've never played Diablo 3 with anybody but my wife and like a friend or two. Right. So I've never played with randos. My wife for a while was playing with randos because she was less bored with the game than I was. She wanted to keep playing it, and I was like, I can't. So
go on to play with randos.
But the experience that she had was basically the exact necessary consequence of this was she would go into a game with other players. Everyone would split off and go do their own thing.
Nobody talks.
Nobody's talking. Nobody will help each other because there's no benefit to doing that. Everybody has their own set of missions that they're trying to accomplish, and there's just no reason to help each other.
Yep.
And
like all of the quote bad parts of the game that people were complaining about were the things that necessitated social interaction, you know? And so there's a strong sense of that miswanting. And I even think about things like, you know, when I'm playing this vanilla WoW version, in the modern game, when there are quest givers, they have an exclamation mark on the map. So you're like, oh, where's the quest? And you're just like, there it is, right? They didn't used to have that. And so if you wanted to get a quest, you had to use your fucking eyeballs and look around town and walk around and explore the space, you know?
Interesting.
And even things like maybe there's a wanted poster tacked on the wall and it's not obvious. Like it's kind of blends in with the wall a little bit, and you mouse over it and it's like, wanted. You're like, what? And you go and you click on it. It's like, oh shit, there's a quest with a whole bunch of money on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you weren't like paying attention, you wouldn't see it. And the developers at the time were like, that's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
They reward you for being present.
Yeah.
And
of course, nowadays, the thing has a big-ass glowing exclamation mark over it, and it's on your map, and there's like – it basically has like a beacon, you know, saying, you know, click on this thing, right? Because now the philosophy is we don't want to put development resources into a quest that not very many people are going to do, right? And so these kinds of philosophies over time
– recognizing that, of course, the fact that most people won't do it
– is what makes it special.
Is what makes it special. And then also the fact that you have to look it. You've looked for it.
And then
– it become a permeating design point.
Yeah, and think about the social implications as well, which is if you say like, oh, like I'm heading over to – I'm finally – like maybe you're in guild chat. And you're like, oh, I'm so excited. I'm going to go to this new town. I'm going to Ratchet. And then somebody's like, by the way, keep an eye out because next to the bank there's a wanted poster there. Be sure to check that out, right? So like other people now share tips about like how to navigate the game better.
One of my favorite things from playing Vanilla WoW back in the day was quest sharing. Because you just show up and like usually if you group with somebody, you'd be like, oh, like we should share quests real quick. Because you actually usually wouldn't know. Because
you would miss a lot of them.
Yeah, you miss a lot.
Because they're everywhere.
Yeah. It's also a social thing. And sometimes you get one, you'd be like, where did you get this? Because I have to go turn this in now.
And then they'd have to explain it to you, or they'd be like, oh, come with me. And then you would travel together to go turn the quest in after you did it, you know. So all these things are things that people complained about.
Mm-hmm.
And they've all been, quote, fixed since then. And the game is – the modern version of the game is really suffering in terms of subscriber numbers and everything. And they've actually stopped announcing subscriber numbers because they just kept going down. And they just didn't want to – deal with that, you know, public PR problem, mm-hmm. right? So there's a whole bunch of interesting stuff with all that. But anyways, so yeah, Fallout 76, I don't know. We'll see. My bet is that this is that same kind of a thing, which is Fallout 3 had this vision mm-hmm. of what this series could really be.
I enjoyed 4.
4 was good. Yeah, 4 was great.
Yeah.
I love New Vegas. 4, they added a whole bunch of these sort of.
Exactly. 4 was the weird one.
Yeah, they added these kinds of mechanics of trying.
This is why I'm saying. Yeah. They're trying to smooth out the experience, yeah. and it just makes it worse, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So my assumption is, based on what I've seen in just about every other game franchise and everything else, is that in the long term, fixing the problems of the game actually kills the spirit.
Yeah, so it would actually probably be better if Fallout 76 was more like Rust, you know, in the sense that
they just went that direction.
Yeah,
well,
no,
in
the sense that it's everyone's fighting for the same loot, you know, and because like the thing is like,
oh right, yeah.
Because the weird part too is, again, I don't know enough about how they actually set up Fallout 76. My understanding is everybody starts as a vault dweller, right? Yep. So you come out of a vault,
come out of the same vault,
which is super nonsensical for like what the game is, because the game is all about you basically competing with the hordes of various kinds of bandits and stuff that are out in the wasteland, right? And there's only one of you and a jillion of them. Like, that's kind of the whole premise. But to have it still be the case that, like, you're the hero on a hero's journey along with all these other heroes. And you're all heroes now, right?
The hero vibes.
And now you're all fighting each other.
You're all the only one last hope.
Yeah.
Every single one of you.
And you're all fighting each other for loot out in the world. And you're, of course, still presumably fighting bandits and monsters and stuff. But it seems like there's a real interesting opportunity there for you to, like, choose a faction, you know, when you come in where – And again, maybe they did this. I don't think they did. Yeah.
Or maybe you choose a vault, you know, and like that's your
starting location.
That's your tribe, you know. Yeah.
Or maybe you do. Maybe there's some of that in there.
Because, yeah, they could have done shit like, because all these vaults have different experiments going on, right? It's like maybe you could have chosen which vault you're coming out of, and like that bestows some like weird genetic mutation on you or something. Like, oh, you got one weird beefy arm.
Right.
Like,
so that's actually
that's your thing.
So that could become kind of a class based thing of some sort.
But having those decisions actually matter and take into account making the player not feel like the one hero, but making them feel like their decisions somehow make them unique in the context of other players. Yeah. You know, like those are the kinds of things that really matter. And even thinking back on something like Diablo 2, the fact that you roll a character, make decisions about your abilities, and those were irrevocable.
Yeah.
Like you'd be like, oh, I'm going to be a blizzard sorcerer or whatever. And that's who you are now.
Yep. Can't get those points back.
And sometimes that is not great, and sometimes it's really great, right? And like, and so because you're now locked into that, then there are scenarios where you really need somebody else to come in and help you because you're like, yeah, my fireballs suck.
They literally do no damage against
them. Literally, they're completely immune to my damage, and I can offer nothing to help in this scenario. Can you carry me through this? And someone's like, sure, no problem, right? Because they know that it'll might come back to them, right? So – I think those things matter, but we'll see, I guess, if this has it. So,
yep.
Anyways, all right. Last news item: elections coming up in the United States.
Yeah, go vote.
Go do the vote.
Go vote.
It's going to come out before the next podcast episode.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's going to come out. The election's launching.
Yeah, election launch.
Election launch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go vote, participate in our democracy, learn shit about the world, and then vote about it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. The end. All right, let's get on to some questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bsketch.net. So if you'd like to get your question on a future episode, get over there, put your question in the text box, and then submit it to us. First question comes from Retro Banana Man NL. Are any of you going to join NaNoWriMo this year?
Oh, no.
That's National Novel Writing Month. It's November. It's when you write a novel.
Yep.
Yep.
Nationally.
We've put a channel in the Discord before.
It's still there, I think.
Is it still there?
We turned
it's
into
just
the writing channel.
It's a writing channel.
So if you're doing it, you can hop on the writing channel with other people who are doing it.
Yeah, and chat.
I won't be doing it this year. I actually started taking 2 online art classes that have been kicking my ass. 7 ways to Sunday, as they say.
Yeah.
What does that even mean? Yeah. I don't know.
It means like every day you're getting your ass kicked differently for a whole week until the next Sunday.
Until the next cycle.
Around.
That's basically what it feels like. So I won't be doing that this year.
I'm still debating, mostly because I've enjoyed NaNoWriMo the most when I was doing it with other people.
Yes.
And of course, it's a solo activity, but just like knowing other people are out there doing it.
We had our spreadsheet where we were comparing numbers.
And there's something about just like having a full work day and then going home and then just being like, I guess I gotta,
need to do
I gotta write now, yeah. I guess. But like, but nobody else is doing it.
Okay, you know what? This comes right back to this, you know, this multiplayer experience versus your actions mattering. Yeah. What if we did a sequential NaNoWriMo where we did it in a rotation, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Where everybody just writes like 500 words and then it's your turn, right? So like somebody write 500 words, somebody else writes 500 words. Maybe you got like four people or something and you're on a rotation. So by the time you write your 500 words, there's 2,000 words that have been already written.
Oh, you're saying on the same project. On the
same project.
So it's clearly not a thing you're intending to like do something with because it's going to be pure chaos in there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially if Seth's involved.
Yeah. As we know. You'd read it and you'd be like,
What
can I do to this?
It basically becomes a Mad Lib game.
It's like an improv. Yeah. But if you have a long enough cycle, if you're writing like 1,000 words or something, I feel like that's enough that you can't just take the story in a dumb direction right away because now you got to live with that decision for the next 900 words and figure out how you're going to make it go.
And it's going to come back on you in a little while.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you really got a yes and this thing.
I think that would be very amusing to do.
It would be pretty fun.
I think
I would be willing to do it in that scenario.
If someone hasn't done NaNoWriMo before, I'd highly suggest it. It's one of those things where it challenges your creative output. And then once you're done, it's kind of doing a game jam basically, but you know, longer essentially.
Yeah,
but once you're done,
like a game slam.
Yeah, you're done and you complete this thing, it's one of those revelations where you frequently will just turn back to yourself and you're like, "Holy shit, I just wrote 50,000 words in a month." Which means, what does that mean, right? That means that you could do that. Thing. So, if anyone hasn't done it before, I'd say definitely take the challenge.
I've only done it the full time once in 2012, but it was a great experience. I had a great time, and looking back on it afterwards, always felt super good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did it halfway last year. Yeah. In the first 4 days, I wrote like 24,000 words.
Yeah, you were trying to get it all done in one go.
Yeah, and then I was like,
I believe you experienced what's called burnout traditionally.
Also, I just, my story, I wasn't really into the story that I was writing.
Yeah.
You know?
You probably wrote it too fast.
I wrote it too fast.
Yeah.
I think that's the problem. I think the first day I wrote at least 10,000 words, I'm pretty sure.
Remember you reported your numbers and each day it like halved. The first day was like 12,000, it was like 6,000. And then you're like, I'm struggling.
I can't. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's also the case that the momentum slows down because, you know, it's just like we talk about with working on a video game, which is at the beginning, anything goes.
Yep.
Right? Like you can take the story any direction you want. And it's fine.
But over time, you guys start living with those decisions that you made in the past.
Yeah, because every new sentence you write
is a constraint on future sentences.
Yeah, it has to take all the preceding story into account. And then, you know, you've also got now, like, you got to start keeping track of, like, okay, what's the personality of this character like? And would this be something that they would say?
Or rolling consequences.
Yeah, and so every subsequent sentence has more and more decision burden placed onto it. So I was tracking my time, and I think – the first like 10,000 words, I was still writing at a good like 50 to 60 words per minute. And normally I type about 110. So that's kind of like about half my time was spent thinking and half my time was spent typing. By the time I got to that tail end, like the last 1,000 words I wrote, I was writing at like 15 words per minute.
Yep.
You know, it's like
– that's a lot to jump.
Yeah, like 80% of my time I was just kind of thinking and staring, which I think is – that's the whole point of NaNoWriMo is to get you to stop doing that.
Yeah.
Probably to like to just write more, but – I don't know. It was hard. It's very hard. If you can do it, props to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's worth doing.
Yeah. Next question comes from French Toast Mafia, who says, love the cast and have listened to every one of them since Touch Arcade turned me to it. Do you find any other industries to provide helpful analogies to solve game dev specific problems?
Yeah. I found that my life in science.
Yeah, you just had this like, revelation. What, like,
as crazy parallel. It hasn't been super helpful exactly, but it's been interesting just how
I think every discipline
it always spills over.
But they're all the same.
The science one from it's like last week.
Yeah,
you
I was talking
with a friend.
Yeah, I was talking to a guy who's a postdoc in my lab back when I was in grad school who has his own lab now. And we were just kind of getting caught up. And we were just talking about how many ways being an academic scientist is basically the same as running a small business in the games industry. Because in science, you basically have to convince somebody to give you a bunch of money, right? Mm-hmm. And you do this by doing a bunch of research and whatever and running up a thing. And then mostly, though, it's through getting the right contacts with people so you can get the right
Yep.
You know, the right names behind you. And
there's no such thing as a true merit-based anything.
No. And then everything hinges on your ability to, every few years, get a large grant to fund your lab for the next 3 to 5 years.
Sort of a game launch
situation. Sort of a game launch situation. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get that, then now you got to start firing people. And now your lab's in trouble, and you might end up in a negative feedback loop that you can't recover from. And so at any given moment, if you miss one of those windows, now you're toast. But also when it comes to research papers, which is sort of the currency that you use in academia, that also is like a launch, right? It's another product that you put out. And just like in the games industry, where when you launch your game, you're competing now with thousands of other games. All the games that have ever been launched, plus the ones that are launched on that day.
Right, there's only so much grant money to go around. There's only,
only so much journal space to go around.
There's only so much human attention to go around.
Yep.
This is the problem. So it's actually the discoverability problem that we have in games.
Because as a scientist, if you write an incredible – this is what we talk about this in games. If you make an incredible game and nobody plays it, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
You know, and, same thing.
And so you have gatekeepers in science who are the editors of the big journals. So in biology, there are a handful of journals. They're called Cell, Nature, and Science. They sort of like really kind of made those very generic names for things. But those are kind of the big three that if you can get if you can get your publication into those, it's sort of like it's a mark of approval, right? Which is exactly what happens if you launch a game and it gets on the front page of iTunes or Steam, right? And if you get it there, then people will trust it and go into it, even despite actually the content of the thing, because they're just looking for that seal of approval. Right. And a huge fraction of people will not look any deeper than that. They will only look at basically the front page of the science industry.
You're saying even professional scientists are approaching their research the same way that somebody finds Candy Crush on the App Store.
Because there's not enough attention. You don't have enough time.
Yeah.
You got to use all these random proxies and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then it's a little bit better there because at least those papers cite other papers. So if you're gonna do the full research, then you can start going through the deep network through, things, right? But all of those are also hugely biased towards those same journals, right?
Right.
And
your starting point is always that casual seal of approval metric.
And it has to be, because how else would you find stuff, right? Unless you're following other, the handful of other scientists you've heard of that are in your field, they're doing stuff that's related to what you're doing. But the main way you're going to hear about those is either by going to a conference and seeing them there, right? If it's a small conference about the thing that you're interested in, or again, by seeing them in the journals that you read, which are – you only have so much time. There are thousands and thousands of papers that come out every day. And so it's the same deal. You got to – it's a discoverability problem. And then you got to use those to leverage the ability to secure funding, for the next thing. And so it's all this positive feedback loop, which is mostly comes down to – your sort of legacy in terms of how you got where you are. So who knows you and who got you there? Who the people, what all the names are associated with you, what success you've had in the past and so on.
And probably how long you've been around.
And how long
you've survived. Because that's essentially also a good proxy for the depth of your network. At that
point. Well, people think that it is. Well, yeah, it's a good proxy for the depth of your network. Yeah, exactly.
Which is
not a good proxy for anything else because of the fact that your ability to survive is a positive feedback loop. Mm-hmm. And so you don't survive for 10 years instead of 5 because you were better. You survived because you survived, right? Yep. And that's the end of the reason,
right?
and the people
and
are
if you
just
didn't survive because you didn't survive,
yeah. And people are just as sort of oblivious to this in academic science, and of course not everybody, but on the whole, people are just as oblivious to this sort of way of thinking as people are in the games industry or any entertainment industry of how much. Of just how much of this is just a probability game and a discoverability problem, and how little of it has to do with how good of a product you make.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of on the other side of that is also just like in the games industry, where most things that are made are not very good, and the people making them are somehow not aware of this. It's the same deal in science. You know, most of the stuff being published is not very good in science. Most of it's not as likely to be. I mean, almost all of it is likely to be false anyway. Yeah. But most of it is actually likely to be false because it was done badly. Not because even if it was done well, it's also likely to be false. Oh my God, Sam, you're ruining everything.
It's fine. You beat.
But yeah, so it's the same deal in both of those. Like, people are just unaware of how much of the problem really just is a discoverability problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the same. I think it's probably the same. And so I told
I think
this
it's every industry is the same.
I think it is, but I think this whole this whole launch-based thing that we do.
Yes.
I think any industry that has that sort of underlying mechanism.
Structure, yeah.
Yeah, then sort of necessarily has to be the same because now you don't get to sort of like incrementally get better, incrementally improve your product, incrementally decrease your cost or whatever. You basically have these giant moments where you roll the dice real hard
yep.
on something you've invested a lot of money into and a lot of time into, and then you just have to hope for the best.
Yeah.
And I think
– and most of the small things that you do in the meantime don't really change much.
Yeah. Or if they do, it's basically – it's like a chaos theory approach. Right? Right. It's like you meet the right person at some point or you yep. do the right thing at some point, and then, you know, 5 years later, all of a sudden that has an enormous payoff that you've never expected.
We've talked about with people on the – I mean, I think we talked about this last week at the podcast,
yeah.
which is this idea of what networking is for. And the reality is that if you don't plan to be around for 3 to 5 years, then it doesn't matter anymore because yeah. most of the connections do not pay off
at all. It's mostly just chaos
there. And the best ones tend to pay off in 3 to 5 years.
Well, and there's an incredible amount of churn. You know, what mm-hmm. we found this may be true in science. I don't know, but that
it's a little stickier, but people actually fall out. Actually, yeah, no, it's probably about the same. Yeah, people fall out really fast in
yeah,
science.
Or at the very least, people will drop out of one studio and move to another. Or maybe you have a contact at some press outlet and then
– they move to another
yeah,
one.
By the time you finish your next game, you send it to their work email and it's gone. Yeah. Right?
It's definitely more stable in academia because academia is sort of historically like people just stay in the same job for like a jillion years, you know?
Yeah.
So there's less of that, but still some.
I do wish – I mean we've talked about this a little bit before, but the fact that – because all of my jobs – prior to working in games were also just really small, like web outfits and stuff like that. So I actually didn't get any of the industry experience in other industries, whether it was IT or like a logging company or logistics company. So I don't have the sort of well of knowledge on some of these other industries that I really wish I had to be able to do some of these cross results. And Seth, you talked a little bit about your experiences, even just working at the stadium before in terms of like, how to think about people and management, all this other stuff. And I think having a breadth of experience before you start your own thing is really nice because it lets you see the pattern before you get maybe entrenched in it.
Yeah, I think it's just true in general that the more depth and diversity of experiences that you have just in life period,
the better served you're going to be.
Yeah, then the more you'll be able to get out of it. As long as you're thinking the whole time.
Yeah.
That was a Freakonomics. They've had a two-part episode about creativity. Over the past couple of weeks, and they've been talking about how one of the biggest determining factors of trying to like measure how creative somebody is comes from their diversity of life experiences, yep. right? So if you grow up in the same place and then you just live in the same place and you go into the exact same field as your parents did and you just kind of like just go by the book on everything. And you don't have any major hobbies and you don't like travel and you don't do anything outside of just like your one core thing, then you have a very hard time with lateral thinking and solving problems in interesting ways.
Well, yeah, you got no ammo, right? You got nothing to pull from.
And I was even just thinking about – like I just had a conversation with Sam yesterday. I was like, you know, as I was learning piano, one of the things that kept coming up over and over again is if there's a really hard song to play it at half speed and then you speed it up. Right. So like once you can play it at half speed, then you go up to 60% speed and then you try to master that and then you keep going. And then pretty soon you're playing it at full speed and it sounds awesome. Right. And this is a common practice among even really, really experienced musicians who you hear them playing like, oh, my God, they did it perfectly. And it's like, well, it's because they started it at half speed. Right. So I was thinking about that then in context with Levelhead.
Yeah.
Because I've been working on putting together this toolkit. We call it cheese mode. Which is to allow you to we call it cheesing the level, where you can place your character anywhere you want when you're building your level and then also apply several sort of extra parameters. So you can kind of like give yourself whatever power-up you want, maybe like even make yourself invincible so that you can just test certain
switches.
Mechanical parts of your level without having to worry about fighting things. Of course, if you beat the level in cheese mode, that doesn't count as a legitimate win. It's just for sort of experimenting and stuff. I was like, what if you wanted to make a really, really hard level and then you could cheese it at half speed, right? So you could turn the game speed down.
During development.
Yeah, while you're building it. Yeah. And then – so you could like practice the level at half speed and then like practice slowly it again. Ramp, oh, yeah, so ramp it up. Because I was thinking about that one guy who spent 2,000 hours in Mario Maker trying to beat his one level that he knows is possible. because he has done this like debug thing where he's like placed himself at various points.
He's played the whole thing in chunks.
He's played the whole thing in chunks. Yeah. And so it's like, well, what if he could slow it down and try to beat, all right, if he can beat it at half speed, it's like, okay, speed up a little bit, you know? And then he can find eat more easily, like take the time to find those spots where the precision has to be just so, you know, and really practice those spots and stuff like that. And so this comes from the fact that I was playing piano, you know, that that now this is a possible thing that we may experiment with and see about putting that into the game. It would not have occurred to me in other scenarios.
Right.
Yeah. So I think the long and short of it is that everything relates 100% to everything else.
Correct.
Just in all possible ways.
Yeah. At minimum, it just changes your brain in some way. And now the next time you solve a problem, you solve it a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. Even if there's not an obvious relationship between the two things.
And so, you know, if you're a programmer, you know, pick up a paintbrush.
Do NaNoWriMo.
Yeah. Whatever it is that you do something else for a while. Yep. And just kind of – it'll forge new neural connections that you didn't know you could even have. So, all right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producer, Fat Bard, for making us sound good. Thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. If you'd like to get more involved in the Butterscotch community, you can hop into our Discord server at discord.gg/bscotch and come say hello. It's getting pretty hopping in there.
Mm-hmm.
We got like a consistent 400-something active people. Yep. So
there's a crowd.
Yeah, we're breaking out into more channels to kind of keep the chaos down, you know. But when Levelhead launches, I don't know what we're going to do about that.
We'll figure it out
or not. You know, those are the two possible outcomes.
Yep.
Also, if you'd like to adorn your body with Butterscotch merch, you can check out our shop over at shop.bscotch.net. Or if you'd like to send us something, we have a mailbox, which you can find the address for over at mailbox.bscotch.net. And last but not least, if you would like to buy some coffee for Butterscotch, you can do so over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.